All right, welcome everyone to the October DEEB meeting. I'm Seth Holling with AKS Engineering. We'll go through introductions first here in the room.
Jeff Riston, Kingston Homes.
Andrew Gunther with PLS Engineering.
Ryan Wilson with Wilson Architects.
Mike Odrin, McKay Sposito.
Eric Kalimo, SGA Engineering.
Brent Davis, Community Development.
Michaela Rankin, Community Development.
Jennifer Reynolds, Clark County Development Engineering.
Houston Ajo, Ajo Construction.
All right, moving to those online.
Sherry Jones, SWCA.
Dan Weisner, Songbird Homes.
Tammy Housley, Jordan Remus.
April 1st, Clark County Community Development.
Devin Rostifer, Clean Water Division Manager, Clark County.
Rod Swanson, Clark County Public Works.
All right, are there others online there that haven't introduced themselves? Go ahead.
This is Jackie Lane, just a member of the public.
Thank you. Well, welcome everyone. Just a reminder, the DEEB meeting is being recorded and the audio will be posted on the website. First item here is to review and adopt the minutes from the prior meeting. Has anyone had an opportunity to review it?
Mr. Chair, I have, but I wasn't here, so I'm not going to move.
Move to approve.
Second.
All right, all those in favor?
Aye.
Next item is to review upcoming events. Megan's out. Brent, would you be able to cover those for us?
I can just cover what's on the agenda. Council meetings, what's listed here is just this week, they considered a road vacation. And then upcoming work sessions, yesterday they had a work session on the fall supplemental budget amendments. Next week, parks and lands capital plan. And then on October 18th, sale and fireworks use and related impacts. I believe there's a possibility we may be having some discussion about the biennial code updates. I'm not 100% clear on that yet. And it doesn't look like there's anything. Back up. Planning Commission tonight. Looks like they're having a work session on the transportation improvement plan, which will be taken 2 weeks later to public hearing on the 19th of October.
Thank you. With that, is there any member announcements?
We had a follow-up to the housing options meeting. I think Dan Weisner, myself, a few others, not from this group, were there. And it was a pretty productive meeting, I think. We'll see what comes out of it. And we'll probably have to add that to the agenda next month. Hopefully we're pretty close to a conclusion after that. We may have to bump it, but maybe hold a spot open for it so we can discuss, or we might have to do it by email too. So.
Is this to address some of the comments and concerns we've had as far as the proposed code language is concerned?
Yeah, we talked a lot about design standards, driveway widths, garages. You know, we kind of got into the conversation again about the cottage code and the garages, and it keeps on getting pushed spot to spot. So I guess we're going to talk about it in biannual codes here in a little bit. But it really should probably be in the housing options since we're rewriting that whole code. But we'll discuss that later and we'll figure out where that one sits. But It was pretty productive. I think we had consensus really with the group on a lot of the items that we talked about, and it was a good discussion. I think pretty productive. So,
do I see Brent?
Yes.
Okay, just making sure. Okay, he'll address that.
Are there any other announcements from the members? Was there anything regarding the House bill and that climate action portion? Was there any update on that?
I did not attend that one. Did we have someone from this group that was going to participate?
I did. It was more geared towards establishing parameters for how to go about doing a climate action plan, because it's a new thing that's being added to the comp plan process. I think they were just trying to figure out how to even, it really wasn't a policy discussion. It was about kind of like who are stakeholders and who needs to be part of this discussion and things like that.
Yeah, in addition, I was on that call, and in addition to who were the stakeholders, they asked a lot of questions about the process for us to weigh in on who should be brought in at what point, timelines, that sort of thing.
Sherry, I think, was an optimist, and Ryan, you're pragmatic. I can't remember.
Okay. Well, with that, then we'll move to the item two on the agenda regarding the assessor's office property system freeze. Sherry, did you have an update on that?
Yeah, just a quick update. So it was more educational than anything. So the assessor's office is required by state law to have their levy certifications done by a certain date, and that's usually in mid-September. So they've pushed their freeze back as far as they can without bumping up to their deadline of mid-September. He just kind of explained that that's key to how they start their levy runs in their budget process at the end of the year. And that's all decided by the Department of Revenue. So what he had stated was, he just asked a lot of questions about how can they do a better job getting the word out so that people can plan ahead and make sure they're getting everything submitted before that timeline. And I believe he said that April had had offered some really great suggestions in that meeting with the county staff on different ways they can push that out to reach more people. So this last year, there were four short plats that were caught in the freeze. He said it's not usually very many, but that's kind of what it is.
Okay, thank you. Next item is the biannual code updates. And Brent.
Good afternoon. So last meeting, I just brought forward a list of the items that we were including in the biannual code updates. Since that time, we've been able to draft the updates, and I provided that. Should have gone out with the agenda. So I'm just going to go over that today, and we can get that up on the screen, and everybody should have a copy in their packets. All right, so the first category of items are Scrivener errors and minor changes. Item number one, making a change to the definition for adult family home. This is driven by changes in state law that allow existing homes to get licensed for up to an additional two beds. So we're just updating our definition to accommodate that. so that we can still classify those as adult family homes. Item number two is in the wireless facilities code. We need to add a provision to be consistent with federal rules, stating that we cannot deny a co-locate if it meets the specific conditions that are listed in the federal rules. So we're just adding a provision to reflect that.
Does that still mean they still need to go through the same process, though?
Correct.
Okay.
It's just a statement that says if it falls within those criteria, we cannot deny it.
Okay.
All right. So the next item is in the road standards, just a Scrivener's error, inserting a comma where one should be inserted. And then the next four items are all in the recently adopted critical errors ordinance that's not yet effective. We found several Scrivener errors, so this is just correcting those. I think the one that warrants a little bit of discussion is there was a misstatement of the threshold for moderate and high habitat function in the wetland rating form for one specific standard, and so we're just correcting that. The others are all grammatical errors and that sort of thing. Number eight, a couple of changes in the neighborhood meeting code for the Type 2A process. At the request of our neighborhood association coordinator, we are changing the name of the meeting to community meeting instead of neighborhood meeting. Apparently that's been creating a lot of confusion with the neighborhood associations and their role or lack of role in the process. In addition to that, they've also requested that we no longer send a notification to the neighborhood association's council chair. That they've stated that they don't need notification of that, so we're just removing that requirement. Number nine, clarification of SEPA thresholds in the site plan code for storage tanks. There was an existing reference that did not align with WAC, so we're just cleaning that up. The next group of updates are what we label as reference updates and cleanups from other code amendments. The first couple here are road standards and road modification code. If you have questions about those, Jennifer is here to address that. And I would just state, if you have questions on any of these items, go ahead and chime in. You don't have to wait till the end. Okay. And then the next group is clarifications. First item, recently, and this was actually added from the list that I presented last month, we recently discovered that the exception from setbacks for fences and retaining walls was not actually clear or expressly stated in the code. And so we're just adding a statement in the section that lists what is accepted from setbacks that includes those fences and retaining walls that do not trigger a building permit. The next item is road standards, deferral of frontage improvements, some clarification there. And again, Jennifer can answer any questions on that one.
A quick question on that one. What if there's just one lot?
Yeah, that one's a little confusing, and maybe we should just pull that one for some discussion, because I think it's maybe a little confusing. It may have unintended consequences.
Sure, and again, I don't think, at least the time I've been with the county, I've seen it been used. It's one of those code sections that doesn't come up a lot, but it just kind of came up recently, and that's why we want to clarify what the original intent was when that was put in.
Okay. The next item is clarification in the exemptions from site plan review for duplexes and triplexes. It was pointed out that the existing language refers to creating and approving lots specifically for duplexes and triplexes, and there's no process that requires those to be declared up front when you're platting. So we're just changing to say that they're exempt wherever they're allowed by zoning. The next group of changes are clarification to the approval process for final site plans and construction plans, because the current process is actually done digitally, so we're removing the language that specifically requires a signature. The next one is a clarification on the provisions that allow deferral of impact fees, and primarily who pays for the recording of the required documents. It wasn't clear that is a applicant expense the way it was stated, so we're just making that explicit. The intent of the language was that the community development would not charge additional fees for those recording documents in addition to the recording fees. And so we're just making it clear that the recording expense is the applicant's. All right, the last group, a little bit more substantive, are some minor policy items. The first item it relates back to the shoreline amendments that were adopted in March 7th. Ecology has had one comment and has withheld final approval until we fix it. And in working with Ecology, we figured out we had a way to fix it without reopening the actual shoreline code. We could do this by correcting a definition in Title 40. So it's a definition of isolated wetlands. And the issue here is that while the best available science guidelines for wetlands allows for certain exemptions for small wetlands, Ecology's policy is that they don't allow those exemptions in shoreline. And they missed that in their initial review of our critical areas ordinance and our shoreline amendments. So we're simply changing our definition of isolated wetlands, which in our critical areas ordinance is tied to those exemptions, to exclude those wetlands in shoreline. And Ecology, we've received a preliminary approval from Ecology to take this route. So once this gets through the process and gets adopted, Ecology can finish their final approval process, and our shoreline amendments and critical areas ordinance updates that were adopted on March 7th of this year will become effective.
Everybody's been waiting around for that.
Yeah, oh. I just want to make sure I understood, right? So if you have a small isolated wetland within the shoreline area, which is 200 feet?
1,000 square feet.
Okay.
The shoreline setback is 200 or the extent of the 100-year floodplain, whatever.
Right,
greater.
Okay. And so then if you have an isolated wetland that ties with that, that isolated wetland, where it extends beyond the shoreline or beyond the floodplain, that all then falls under shoreline, correct?
That's correct. There, okay. It's an associated wetland, and that's true for any wetland.
Yeah.
The thing here is that in our critical areas ordinance, those small isolated wetlands are exempt from buffer standards and exempt from the mitigation sequencing.
We're talking about the 1,000 square foot one.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Okay. And so the distinction is, with this change in the shoreline management area, those exemptions will not apply. You will have to apply buffers. You will have to go through mitigation sequencing if you propose to fill them.
And that would be whether they are wholly within shoreline or partially within shoreline?
Correct, because if they're partially within shoreline, they actually extend
the
shoreline area.
Yep,
but
yep.
But the buffers do not.
Oh, okay. Oh, interesting.
We had the option when we did our shoreline update in 2012 to exclude wetland buffers from the shoreline management area, and we chose to do that.
Got it.
So.
Thank you.
All right. The next update is some amendments to the rural ADU standards, trying to align the rural standards with the changes that are being proposed for the urban ADUs, primarily in clarifying what the floor area that we use to calculate the size of the ADU and excluding garages from the rural ADU. They still have to be attached. That's a GMA requirement. And also, I think there was some clarification of where you had to put the access for those ADUs because the current language was confusing. It made it sound like your access had to be internal because it was describing a position on the primary structure. So we clarified that also.
So it looks, if I'm reading this right, it's now just saying that the rural ADU size is capped at 1,500 square feet regardless of the size of the primary residence. So you could have a 1,500 square foot ADU on a 1,000 square foot house?
That's correct. We're following the proposed changes in the urban, which is just limiting it to a fixed size as opposed to making it proportional to the existing structure.
I guess it just feels funny to have an ADU that's bigger than the primary residence, but that's fine with me.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it was very complicated in many cases trying to figure out what the existing size was. Do the garages count? I have this uninhabitable space. Does it count? And this is just much simpler.
And I think that may be repeated in the housing options because we just looked at it and we noticed the ADU code had the garages excluded. So it may be that when this gets adopted and if the housing options get done before this, it may be irrelevant. It might already be updated.
So the housing options is only modifying the urban code.
Okay.
And this is the rural ADU. So we're trying to align them and keep them as similar as possible.
Good idea then.
And in addition to that, we're exempting the rural ADUs from site plan review as well.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
I understood rural had to be attached. Is that still the case? And it cannot be detached from the structure?
That is correct, and that is a GMA requirement.
One clarification to that, it can, but it's really fuzzy to implement. The only way you could detach it is if you actually have a lot that's twice the size that it has to be. So the GMA rule doesn't say they have to be attached. It just says that it can't increase the density. So technically, if you had a R10 lot and it was 20 acres, you could do it but our code isn't set up because it's really complicated and it really doesn't happen. They just short-plat it. But in that circumstance, you could if you're a GMA county.
So you're saying
it counts against your density is what
the county could do that, but county's not using that standard.
It gets really complicated, and you know, I think it would be an exception in that case, but most of the time you just short plat it and have it a separate lot instead.
Yeah.
But technically, GMA doesn't say you can't, they have to be attached, but it says it counts against the density, the way I understand it.
Yeah, but then if you short plat it, then you have to have a separate septic system and everything.
It gets really
else.
Fuzzy.
Yeah.
I think
Class B, well. Sure, well,
there's a lot of momentum at the state level to change that.
Yep.
So I would expect in the next year or two, they're going to allow detached rural ADUs.
It seems like with everything else they've done, that would make sense.
It almost happened this session, and it somehow got left off. So,
okay.
But there's a lot of momentum now. So we'll see if it gets picked up this session.
Okay.
April, I saw you had your hand raised. Did you have something to add on that?
One of the other points for the rural ADU is that. When you're on those bigger lots and you allow it, and it's just to piggyback off of what Eric was saying, they're trying to prevent you to from someone splitting and selling that other parcel with the ADU. That makes sense. With an urban lot, you're not going to run into that because the lot is so tiny. But when you go to the rural, you basically could have two homes on 2 acres, and you know as well as I do that you could split those with the assessor, and then you could split it and then sell it when that's not a legal lot of record.
Yeah, that would be an illegal land division.
It would be a legal lot then.
Yeah.
Unless it was over there.
But it's already got the home, so that would be a way of circumventing the platting process because you've already gotten the building permit because the house is already there.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
All right. The next item is increasing the public notice radius in our Type 2, Type 2A, and Type 3 and Type 4 processes. So we're increasing the urban radius to 500 feet, the rural radius to 1,000 feet. And then also we're reflecting that in the community.
Brent, real quick question about that. And maybe April would need to answer it. So that just is the parcels themselves, not ownership. Is that correct? Meaning, would it extend out if there was contiguous ownership?
The code as it currently reads, and we're not proposing to change that part of it, is that it is from the contiguous ownership.
It is.
Yes. So if the applicant owns adjacent property, then it would be the radius from the extent of their ownership. Their contiguous ownership.
So it could go out further if an applicant has a parcel of land that they're proposing development on and owns a parcel next to it that they're not proposing development on, then that could actually extend that notification out further.
Correct. And that's the way the code is currently structured.
Okay. Interesting. All right.
Yeah, I think the intent there is to make sure that neighbors are notified, right? If somebody happened to, and maybe it's not as critical with these larger radii, but with a 300 foot radius,
you can buy up all the property and nobody's notified.
Right.
All right. I'm with you.
Okay. And the other change there we're making is that we're also increasing the notification radius on the community meeting for the Type 2A process to 1,000 feet. It was 500, or it is 500 today. The next item is. We're proposing to add a requirement for a pre-application conference for a major home business. Well, there's a typo there. It's actually a Type 2 review. What we're finding is a lot of these applications are coming in that are way off the mark in terms of what the standards allow, particularly ones that are coming from folks that have started their business before they've gotten their approval. And it's been very challenging to get applicants to understand the limits and restrictions in that code. All right, the last item is changing the venue requirements for the community meeting in the Type 2A process. The code states that it has to be at a site within a reasonable distance of the proposed development site. Through COVID, we've been allowing those meetings to occur virtually, and we propose to continue that allowance. And that is the extent of what's in the current draft. There was, and I don't know, April, if do I? Oh, I'm sorry. Correct. Thank you. These are non-Title 40 changes that we're sharing with you because they impact the work that we do here. The first one is a fire code, a change in the county's version of the fire code that relates to security key boxes and the requirements of what is supposed to be put in them. My understanding is that the fire marshal has never enforced those requirements, so we're just removing them. And then the last item is in the building code, removing the exception that's in the building code for agricultural structures. And Max is here. He can speak more to that. There's questions about that.
we went over it last time briefly, but basically the State Building Code Council, or the State Building Code doesn't provide the same exception, so we're updating our code to be more consistent with the state's code on those buildings. They've also been a resource problem, quite frankly, to be able to deal with. And so that's the basic gist of it. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
So the bottom line is that there'll be building permits required now for these?
Correct.
What about ones that are already built?
Just like everything now, if it's a legally established structure, okay, it would remain that way until such time as they change the use or otherwise modify.
Code enforcement actions or?
Even then, I mean, if it's a legally established structure and still being used consistent with how it was established, it would remain just like a house built in 1950. Doesn't meet any semblance of the building code today.
Thank you.
And until they come and tear the roof off and tear the walls off, it can just stay like it is. Yeah.
Is there a process for conversion of an ag building? This comes up quite often, and
I know.
I'm like, yeah, good luck with that. to find an engineer or someone that's going to basically do plans after the fact is almost impossible. It's almost more work than tearing the thing down and rebuilding it the same exact way.
We are working internally on processes for dealing with what we call as-built structures, whether it's an ag building or something else that was built without a permit, in order to kind of help the innocent purchaser of these things. And we actually have made some headway on that. I'd be happy to maybe bring a presentation next time with regard to what we've been working on with that.
That would be great. I actually have a project right now
okay.
in that situation. So
our thought is twofold, basically, is that many of the ones we deal with are people who didn't build them, for one, and two, who are to some degree voluntarily getting them permitted. It's a little different when you've got someone who built it last summer, defiantly, and now is trying to fix the problem, versus something that was built 20 years ago and someone has now inherited because they bought the property. So yeah, I'd be happy to, if we can add that to the agenda for next time, or whatever, I'd be happy to give a presentation, let you know kind of what our thinking is for the building permit process for that type of conversion. But then the second part of that to your question is, this is another reason we're seeking to kind of get rid of this, because back to the resource issue, converting these things, it's a difficult thing. We'd like to find a way to offer a permit for an unheated accessory structure of this nature that was kind of on the express level, if you will, for a quicker, easier review to lower the bar some, if that makes sense.
I see Terry has his thing in, but just to finish this conversation before we move on to that one, there was a similar process that this board and a group from the chamber took a few years ago, and it was around something similar. It was conversion of non-permitted tenant improvements, and that came up a ton in the county because they didn't really have a business license. So when you change the occupancy, there was almost no documentation for it at all. And there wasn't a lot of records of it. So basically, I think what we landed on was basically a safety check.
Yep.
It wasn't like having to go back through the permitting. It was a voluntary thing to bring it up, and it was a safety check. The fire marshal or someone went in, did a quick look, and said, you know what, this looks okay. It's not usually external structures. It's not like it's internal things, making sure it's wired correctly. Minor items, and then it was documented. So I would encourage you to kind of look at that process and kind of spin off of this thing.
Was that called Fresh Start? Is that what they called
it? Maybe. It was part, I think it might have been.
I feel like I remember that. Just
yeah.
The end of that.
It was, I think, before you were even here.
Right. I remember, I think I showed up at the tail end of
what
was happening, but I'll go dig through the records and see what I can find on that.
I probably have a file on it too, because it was okay. I was in the work group, but I just wanted to bring that up as a reference point. So
super.
I'll turn this over to Terry.
Mine, Max, is more so like on the real estate agent side, right? They'll end up encountering this where improvements could have taken place and it's hard to place a time on that. You can sometimes try and figure it out based off satellite imagery. That usually is probably your best indicator. Would it be, let's say it's a trust that then has this property or someone selling a property, but a buyer is wanting to verify that, hey, they're not getting themselves exposed in some permitting quagmire. If they were to look, I guess it would be good if you could explain when you talk about this further, kind of how the county would look at that aspect to help people who represent either a buyer or a seller on how the county will look at that. That will help to kind of us to educate those that are going to be handling this process as far as if it's a potential permit issue or not. And I'm assuming we're not talking about retroactive. We're just talking about it's a certain date and it goes forward and being aware of that date.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Currently, I don't know what the date is. Maybe April can remind me. But currently what we've done, this is a shift that made that April made in the permit center when she was there. You have a structure that's a certain age or older and it's not being lived in, would be the only caveat. There used to be a time where you were required to get a building permit for this unpermitted structure before you could obtain the permit for whatever the new project was. And we've moved away from that by basically saying, put a note in the plot plan, the approved document saying this building is not permitted and this permit doesn't somehow grandfather the thing or whatever. It's still the owner's responsibility to get a permit. They find themselves in code enforcement next year because of their cranky neighbor. They will still have to deal with that building, but it was a way of saying, let's move forward on the permitted work in front of us. Whatever we've been using for the date on that is, I think, the leaping off point for these things. The other thing you find is, provided the building in question wasn't, that's how this usually comes up. You have an old shop that was built in 75 or 80, a permit was required at the time, but if it's just being what it is, apart from a code enforcement action, it just can stay what it is, generally speaking. Usually where this comes up is, something triggers something that says, well, now they've put an apartment in there, or now they've somehow updated it without a permit, and now we are going back because the thing was never permitted, and to get the whole thing right, you're bringing all of it back back to square one. So I can certainly include some of those dates and ideas in the presentation.
That was about March of 21, and I had like three decks that people wanted to get permitted, but they had unpermitted structures on their plot, on their land, and we weren't allowing them to have these deck permits, but they had, you know, in 2021, there's a whole bunch of people buying property. So we had all these people that bought property and were trying to do the right thing now that they owned it, but we were saying, no, you have to permit that structure before I'll even let you have your swimming pool or your deck. And so that's why we switched to that, because I didn't want to stop work when someone was, I wanted to encourage people to get permits, not the other way around. So.
Yeah, I remember you talking about that. I think that's a great, otherwise, yeah, you're right. It would end up just, things would happen without permitting, and easing that barrier helps to keep everyone following the process.
I still had one thing. I don't want to, until you're done with this subject, but I did want to before we went away from biannual.
Yeah, I think, go ahead, April.
Were you going to cover it?
Are you talking about the cottage housing?
Yeah, I was going to say, Eric alluded to it a little bit. Okay, you go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was just going to, and maybe Eric can help answer the question, because April and I had a discussion with Oliver last week, and Jose about the excluding the garages from cottages, and they indicated that a decision would be made at the meeting today as to whether it would move forward in cottages or not, and we agreed that if it wasn't, that we would bring it forward with these biannual code amendments. And I've already drafted the language, and I can insert it quickly. I can send it out after this meeting if that's the direction we're going to go.
Yeah, I think there's a communication issue, and we alluded to it in the meeting, and we just said, you know, I think that's all it is, really, is a communication issue, because they said that they were going to do it with biannuals, and from what I've heard from the biannuals, we're going to do it with the cottage, or with the housing options. And, I mean, I tell you, personally, I think it's more appropriate with the housing options, because this is, it's not trying to be a minor change. This is a major policy change with the entire thing together, and it should be looked at as a whole. So I think the best way to do it, even if it's not necessarily the quickest way, but I think the housing options is probably ahead of it at this point. And I think it should be in the housing options. Everything else that's similar like that is being, you know, introduced there.
It sounds like the perception of it too would be better to have it within the housing options than a one-off in here.
Yeah. There's way more significant changes being proposed in the housing options than counting a garage in a cottage. I mean, it's across the board. There's pretty big significant changes. So I would put it there, and it's really probably shouldn't be in the biannuals. I think it'll complicate your biannuals
And it really shouldn't. It should. It's, if it's going to complicate anything, it should be the housing options, because that's where it is.
I think April, either way, one of us is going to. Whether it does housing option or it goes biannual, one of us will take it through.
Remind me, sorry, on mixed use, which if you have some crossover as far as there's, you want to have multiple housing types, and that that floor square footage and garage is something that I believe gets pulled in with mixed use as well. Will that get cleared up with this too? Is my question.
No, we would only be addressing the cottage and ADUs.
Which is that section were you talking about? The
on mixed use, I.
That's the next batch.
This next batch.
Next batch. Okay. Regardless, it's yeah. So there's two batches to the housing options. Right now, we're just looking at the single family ones.
Okay.
There's a whole other batch that's going to happen with multifamily product, and that will be in the next batch.
Got it.
So,
okay.
Yes, we will.
And that will include mixed use as well?
Because that would be considered more under the multifamily
yep.
than it would under the single family.
Okay.
So, yeah, we're just, it, not that it's not in there, it's just not in there yet.
And so that, that's going to be the time to bring up some of the things that
yep.
Seth brought up yep. 9 months ago or whatever. Okay,
yep.
cool.
What's the approximate kind of timeline that happens? Is there one that's proposed?
It is supposed to follow the single family, so it got put on hold. We were
yeah.
already supposed
it
to start
started.
Meeting on that
Everything
one.
Yeah.
Did it start?
Yeah, multifamily started. I think we had one, or I don't
yeah.
know anybody
I think
else
I'm on that
was
one
on
too,
it.
But I don't
I think
remember.
We had one or two, and then it got paused.
That's
yeah.
what it was. It got
yeah.
paused to finish the single family stuff. Same kind of group of people working on it. I mean, so.
So would it be safe to say end of 24?
Maybe.
Potentially?
Maybe. I mean, yeah. That's as good as any guess.
Yeah.
right
okay.
Now.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. So to wrap up, just a bit about schedule for this process moving forward. And I don't know, April, if you know, are we still on schedule for October 18th for work session, or are we getting that changed?
I actually don't know if it's October 18th or November 1st. I'll check.
Okay. If we have time on the 18th, it may not be enough to actually cover it. My understanding is the council's schedule is very full, and they decided to try to squeeze it in, but I don't really want to go to a work session if I don't have enough time to present the issues. So we're working through that. But the idea is to get a work session either by the end of the month or early November, and then we'll give the 60-day notice to Commerce once we have council on board with the changes, and then we'll get scheduled with Planning Commission and get it moving.
So April, real quick, on the cottage garage thing, are we pretty much, I think, all in consensus that we're not doing it with biannuals and we're moving it to the housing options?
If housing options study does not put it in, I will put it in biannuals.
Okay. But the recommendation, so they wanted a recommendation from us, and they were fine adding it in. They just thought the direction was different. So if we want to...
It's going into biannuals.
Why? Why?
I think
because
council directed us.
They gave us direction. Well, they gave redevelopment direction to do it in the next cycle. So we're just honoring their direction, period.
But wouldn't you think that would be different if they knew that it's more appropriate to be in another one? I think that was before we had the housing options code that was coming forward. So this was like way before the housing options even started that they said, let's do it on the next one. They didn't know this bigger one was already happening.
Ask them again.
Yeah, I don't know. It just seems way more appropriate. I think it was out of context.
Either way, it's
going forward.
Okay.
Yeah,
well,
so I think... I can talk to April more about this, but I think my thought is that with this uncertainty, unless we get clarification from community planning that they are taking it forward.
There's no uncertainty. You're following the council's direction, period.
Okay, so council direction is to have it in the biannuals?
Yes.
So we'll include it, and if council
wants
to move it, they can move it.
I don't think council understands. Can I make a motion that we recommend to council to include it in the housing options because it better fits it and it's part of a holistic approach to the housing options, and that's more appropriate than the biannuals?
So
So the question I would have is that it's been an issue that we've been dealing with and trying to get rectified, and now we have consensus with everybody. And so why don't we just get it taken care of and it's done? So that would be the other side, the other argument to the other side.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that the housing options is ahead of it now. So that the housing options didn't even exist when they made that recommendation.
Oh, I see what you're saying. That the housing options will move forward and be in effect prior to the biannuals.
Yep.
I see.
I think it didn't exist. If they knew that the housing options was coming, they would have said do it then. But it wasn't even a thing. So I think their direction is it was too. We weren't ready at the other biannuals. This is a bigger issue. Well, this is the perfect time to do it because this is a lot bigger issue of the stuff we're dealing with the housing options. So I guess we can make a motion. Council can decide, but we would recommend that they include it in the housing options and it be looked at with the comprehensive changes to all of that code instead of making it a one-off. Like, and that's inconsistent with everything else we're doing. So that would be our recommendation to council. And if they still want to say no, I don't think they're going to. Because it's one of those things that just doesn't make sense. So,
can I ask a quick question on the biannuals? Has something changed? I mean, I know there's always been creep into the biannuals, but biannuals were always meant for things like Scrivener errors, mistakes, you know, clarifications, not major policy changes. I mean, there's several things I could point out here that I think, you know, potentially cross the. I'm just curious if I missed a change in intent of what biannual codes. Again, I've witnessed creep for over 30 years where they become more significant than they used to. But
I don't see in here where
they used to read something in the beginning that's saying, you know, the purpose of biannual codes is to do, you know, Scrivener errors, things like that. There used to be like a.
Yeah, it's right at the top of this document where it says, you know, it includes minor policy changes. So
minor policy changes.
Yeah.
Anyway,
from our perspective, a lot of those minor policy changes come at some direction from council. So, for instance, the notice radius change, that is something that they asked us to explore, and so. We're bringing that forward to them through this process.
But council has been, because, you know, council is different now. There are more of them. There's change of guards, things like that. They are familiar with what the biannual code is supposed to accomplish. I mean.
Yeah, well, I think we will revisit that at our next opportunity, which will be our work session. For this process, and I think it probably needs to be part of the discussion every cycle to remind the council of what the process is.
Yeah, both
council and planning commission are fully aware of what they feel are policy issues and aren't policy issues from personal experience. So,
yeah.
And what should and shouldn't be in a biannual code process. So we can always leave that up to them. As far as their interpretation of that is concerned, I don't see anything in here that's a major policy issue. So
no,
just consistency.
Yeah.
So I guess the motion would stand that I would recommend that we do the cottage garages with the housing options code because it's more appropriate and it's holistic and it looks at major policy changes and that's the most appropriate place to put it.
All right. Well,
I'd second that.
Motion second. Any discussion?
Yes. I just want to make sure that how much further after the housing options, I mean, this has already been kind of kicked down the road, the housing options process has been kicked down the road. What's the guarantee that that's going to not be kicked down the road even further and might, you know, follow behind the adoption of the biannuals? Do we have some assurance that what we're proposing is actually going to speed this up?
So I guess my thought on this is that's almost irrelevant because it's where it's most appropriate. Even if it does follow later, we should look at it together. We're looking at major overhaul changes to those code sections. Why not include the one that also impacts it where it belongs. The whole reason for the biannual code change was almost a year and a half ago when there was no sight at all of this housing options code. So yeah, they pulled it because there was a bigger policy change that needed more discussion and work groups and all that. Those work groups have happened now. All that stuff has happened now. We've done it holistically with this housing options committee. It's gone on for quite a while and lots of discussion, and there's recommendations. We don't even know if that's going to be the final recommendation, but I would recommend that we do it with that, and it's heard with all the other housing options code. The only reason the rural ADU one, and Brent stated it very, very well, the only reason that's in here is because we weren't looking at rural stuff
right.
with the housing options because it just covered urban stuff. So that one makes perfect sense to be consistent. I don't know. It just doesn't make sense to like not include it with the housing options when the whole purpose of that was to do it in advance of this. Now we've caught
right.
up to it. It's
right.
been kicked so far down, it should just be in there.
Okay. Fair enough. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions or discussion?
Yeah.
If not, call a vote. And everyone in favor, aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Jamie, just to clarify, was that for or against?
Who was it?
Who was that?
I'm for. That was Dan that was for as well.
So no
Dan.
No,
okay.
So that's unanimous.
Yeah, unanimous. All right. And as far as the rest of these biannual code amendments, is there any more questions or discussion? Should we consider a motion?
I have one thing. I would say that I don't know who it was that said these seem a little bigger than biannuals, and I don't know if I would particularly disagree, except for the state has done legislation with land use more than, I mean, I think what they're doing is more than what they've done in 20 years, and we're trying to align with that. And so that's why I would say they're minor policy changes, because they're just aligning with the state.
And I agree. The alignment with the state and all, I don't have any issue with. And I really don't have any issue with, other than what we were talking about being a, I could make arguments for them, but they're fine.
Okay. Thank you.
Other than what we talked about.
Yeah. Just general consensus. I think they all look really good. There's the only one that I was like not quite sure of, and I don't know that it clarifies, was the whole frontage improvement. And I think the idea is that if you're doing a two-lot short plot, just to split out the existing home and defer frontage improvements for the whole thing so it's done with the development later, that it's done with the development. So I don't know. I think we're maybe accomplishing that. I'm just confused. So I guess if I'm confused, other people may also be confused. I don't know. That's it. I mean, that's the purpose. And I know what you're trying to achieve, because if you have you'll have a two-lot short plat where you're doing, the idea is to split the existing house off on 1 acre, and then the rest of it's going to get developed in a development later. And you're deferring them to when the development is done, and then all the frontage improvements are done with that instead of up front. That's the purpose of that code originally. So does this clarify that to make that more clear?
Repeat what you just said.
Okay.
So I make sure I got what you were saying.
The purpose of the deferral is to allow, if you have a parcel that's larger than 2 acres, and you have an existing home on it, that you'd be able to split that home off on 1 acre, and then you can sell the other acre and do a deferral of the frontage improvements without having to do it with this short plat, because you know there's going to be a larger development in the future that actually can support those improvements. The purpose of these small short plats like that is that, and that's an exemption, but you have to have an acre. There's things that are a piece of it. But what you don't want to do is have it so when that development comes through, the deferral never happens. So the frontage improvements get done when the major development is done, not in the initial split off, because that split off would not be cost effective with just one lot. That's the idea of why the exemption's there.
Well, so I think there may be some confusion. We have another exemption for two-lot short plats for that specific thing, where they're exempt from frontage improvements outright. So this is not that. This is, and I've just seen it used recently to do what you're saying, split off an existing home into its own lot, but then also develop the other lot into urban density lots, thus by not having to do frontage improvements on that acre lot. And that was not the intent, because by doing that, you can also circumvent other codes, such as circulation, street extensions by strategically placing that lot in a way that would allow you to do that while still being able to develop and get other lots.
Yeah.
So I really want to just remove, I just want to remove the code language because it doesn't benefit, you can't create multiple 1 acre lots, if that's my understanding, in the urban zone. So it might just be one of those code sections that just needs to be removed so that someone doesn't try to use it and argue it in the future.
Yeah. I guess my caution is I think the intent was just what I said, and as long as we have language that meets that intent, but I think it might be a little confusing. So I would say, you know, I'd recommend, recommending all of these for adoption, just making sure to look closely at that one to make sure we're still hitting that intent. Otherwise, I would make...
I mean, my suggestion would just be to delete it altogether.
I think that might have unintended consequences, too, because we want to have something saying if you're taking advantage of that one lot acre development, which you can only do that if it's a two lot, 1 acre maximum, this coincides with the other language giving the 1 acre. So it's in different code sections. This is like a transportation code.
So then I think this one would then need to be revised to just say a two-lot short plat, if that's...
But isn't there an exemption already?
There's already an exemption for a two-lot.
You can't do a three-lot short plat because the code doesn't allow it.
That's what I'm saying.
So
I think
you don't need to... Yeah.
I, that's why I think that someone could be using it to create one-acre lot and then develop the rest into the urban density.
Yep. And are you saying in this instance that this is... That frontage improvements would then be required if they did a subdivision which included the existing house. That frontage improvements would be required on that lot as well.
That's how it is now. Yeah, that's what Covenant Running has done.
What they're trying to prevent, Mike, is if you have 100, say you have 120 feet of frontage, and you have a house, if you go take that house, break it out, and put 100 feet of that frontage, or 90 feet of the frontage on the house, and then you just have a 30-foot access. I think that's what you're talking about, correct, Jennifer?
That's a good example.
And then the purpose of the exemption is to allow it to just be deferred. So we just need to make sure it aligns with that piece. So we don't want to have that loophole. We want to close the loophole because that makes it so the county never gets their frontage improvements. We have these broken neighborhoods and improvements. We don't want that. But we also want to be able to, you know, then sell if it's grandma trying to sell her home and then selling it to a developer and has no development experience, that they can split that lot off of the two-lot short plat, sell the whole thing to a developer, disclose that there's a covenant when this develops, that those improvements have to go with it, and then that development can happen. That's the purpose of it. So as long as that language is in line with that, that's what it's supposed to do. So, and that's it. Otherwise,
I think there's developers out there already that have already used that in commercial zones.
Probably.
Yeah.
And
I know.
Half lots, that's different. those are different. Yeah. So as long as that's it, I think it's just clarification. I would say, so I guess to clarify the motion, we recommend, approval of all of the biannual code amendments with just a little clarification on the clarification too. So, and I think we're all on the same page. Yeah. Just the best way to write it. You know, there's not really any difference of opinion. It's just trying to make sure it's as clear as possible.
I'll second that.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Any discussion? All right, hearing none. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? All right, motion carries.
Thank you, Brent.
Thank you, Brent.
Thank you.
All right, the next item is stormwater concerns. Eric?
Yeah, I'm hoping this is a really quick one. I think we might have clarified it a little bit. It's more just, it came up from a few builders, and when the engineers do a stormwater design and they do engineering plans, they have to make an assumption for roof areas and driveway areas. Now, if it varies during construction, all I'm thinking is we just need a simple way to do it very quickly. And the complaint, I guess, came out because one builder had it come up, and I have the timeline. You know, it came up on 4/28, and it went through a post plan change to adjust everything. And it's just that the county was really busy, and I have no doubts that was the case. They have other things on their plate. There's a house. There's a building permit in for a house.
this post-plan change needed to happen before that. It finally got approved on 6/16. So it was, you know, from 4/28 to 6/16. And Jennifer, I think the intent's good, but in practice, kind of having some stated policy on how to handle those, I think it's there. But maybe passing that down to the people that are actually doing the work and making sure that they can happen quickly, because these are always an emergency. And sometimes it can be handled that some houses are bigger than others. Maybe it's an accounting exercise and we do it. Other times, maybe the system was oversized already and all we have to do is add a little extra perf pipe or some other way to handle it that can be quickly done. It could maybe be done with a letter. I know when we have setback encroachments, there's a clarification letter that the building department accepts from engineers sometimes. Maybe it can be handled something like that, that somebody is accounting for it. It didn't get overlooked. It's just that here's the way it was clarified, and you can put it in the file and we move on, and hopefully it's simple. Sometimes it's not as simple as we want it to be though, and it requires a post-plan change. But in those cases, I guess what I thought I might bring it forward and see if we can come up with a way to do it simply.
This happens on almost every subdivision, I think.
Yeah, and I don't think it used to tell you the truth. I think for years and years, it was probably just overlooked. And it was the assumptions were close enough, and they didn't go back and check them. Now, it became something where now I think it's being checked, and because it's being checked, it's an extra kind of layer. And most of them work, some of them don't. And almost in every development, there's probably one that exceeds it.
Yeah.
Or some that don't.
And especially when you have you have certain assumptions with one developer and they sell the whole thing, and then you have another developer come in and their product is completely different, and now how do you then dovetail and rectify those differences?
And roof areas are usually easier as long as it's like infiltration. Yeah. If it's a lateral and it goes to a system, it's a little more complicated. But a lot of times you can supplement it with some like LID technique, like you do a perforated connection instead, where even if you're not getting full infiltration, you get rid of some of it before it goes to the system. It maybe gets rid of just the excess. Or on a driveway, say you plan for 500 square feet and they put in 600. You put a strip of pervious pavers on the edge and you do something that it makes up that difference, and it can be done very quickly instead of having to go back through rerunning the WIM models, taking 2-3 months when they're sitting on a building permit and not hitting a deadline. And that's I guess what's been happening.
And we wouldn't want to necessarily contemplate, you know, full coverage of that, because that rarely happens where you're maxing out the lot coverage. That really no, and that would be oversizing all kinds of stuff from a stormwater standpoint, and probably creating more issues down the road.
Yeah. So that's it, and I think you know it was just more bringing it to our the attention of staff, because this is probably the most appropriate place to bring it up, and just trying to find a good way to do it. So that was it. It's more of starting a discussion, and I don't know that we need to resolve it today, but maybe we can figure out a good way to do it, and it can be maybe resolved with a policy paper or something. So.
I just have a few things to say, and I think staff is aware of this, both in the permit center who's taking in the building permits, and then also with development engineering review engineers that are reviewing those individual lot drainage plans with the construction plans. And so I think we've found a couple avenues, and it's a little different if you have if the stormwater management is just on an individual lot basis, each is self-contained. That's really easy for the design engineer to just, you know, if it's this size, it's this big, and you just increase it incrementally as your house gets bigger. It's more, I think, a concern on the collective systems where everything's draining to one facility, and you just want to make sure if this one lot increases their square footage, it's not something that's going to happen across the board. And so I think we've had one way to do that was accountability letters that the engineer submits with each building permit, just outlining how much surface they've built so far. But when it comes to increasing driveways, you add another element, because if you're using a cartridge system in the road, you increase so many driveways, you might increase the amount of cartridges that you need. So it's like, it's not a one-size-fits-all thing, but we are kind of aware of it, and we don't want you, just as much as you don't want to have to go through the post-plan process, we don't want you to have to, so we're trying to get it so it can be documented with the engineering plans, and the engineer can be the one at time of building permit to to rectify any differences in the roof or driveway area.
Yeah. So I think like something like the LID driveway in those situations where if you do go slightly over, it's not like a huge impact, but you can probably get rid of enough stormwater in that situation. So it's really not an impact for those storms on the cartridge system. So, and if you can get a stamped letter, I think it's one of those things that the county covers their bases and it doesn't slow down the process. So maybe consider something similar to that, where we look at, okay, in those cases where it goes over, we're going to do LID driveways. We're going to increase the perf pipe in the other situations. Trying to find the best way to do it so we don't slow things down. Is it?
I guess another idea on that is it possible as part of the as-built process to look at what the actual tested infiltration rates were during construction and in that on the as-built sheet increase your roof areas that are allotted, or maybe even put like a total, like here's the amount that's extra available for this development. It can be distributed between the lots and then have an accounting letter in that way. Say maybe you have 5,000 square feet extra for these 30 lots and then it's, I guess it could be first come, first serve until you use that up.
Yeah. And we're going to try to redo our plans a little bit now that this has become a bigger issue and put lots of options on them. Because I think what happened was, you know, we had lots of options on them, and through the review process, like, no, you got to be more specific. And then it didn't match. So we're kind of going back to that and trying to put, like, you know, what happens if it goes over? Kind of like this, like, build it right into the plans, but it doesn't help for the old ones. So we're going to try to do better on our end too by putting those options on the plans. So it's really, we have a flow chart almost if it goes over. Like, here's our assumption. If it goes over, LID driveway, more perf pipe, kind of build it right into it. And maybe that works for you guys, but it's those ones that are caught in between. So, but that's it. And I don't want to spend a lot more time on it. I just wanted to bring it up as an issue. And I'm pretty confident we have, you know, reasonable people and we can figure out a good way to do it. So that's, I don't want to spend too much more time, but if we maybe have to talk offline and come up with a policy, you know, I'm willing to help. And maybe Mike seems to be pretty familiar with it too, but yeah. And Andrew, so.
It's come up, and I would, you know, if it's going to be a discussion, I'd encourage getting somebody from our firm in there too to see if they've got any ideas about how to best solve it.
Yeah, my sense is that maybe there's a good path to deal with this for systems that are infiltrating, and probably realistically, you know, detention systems are going to be tougher to deal with. And if there's at least small pieces we can bite off to simplify, something's gained at least at that point. So,
yeah, we just submitted one on 10-3 that basically was a clarification of the infiltration system. And we maybe use that as a pilot. I'll let you know how it goes and maybe keep you in the loop on it so you can kind of see how it's handled and, you know, we can learn from it.
All right, we'll move into the next item, number 5, the comp plan planning assumptions. Eric.
Yeah, and I've been semi-involved in this. I was involved with it more on the first one, but it kind of just came out of the comp plan process. And previously, this board made recommendations on some of the planning assumptions in the VBLM. And I guess what I would say is we should probably reiterate those concerns in a new memo to the council of what those are. Things like infrastructure percent deduction, the deduction for schools and parks up front, the market factor. You know, there were a lot of those pieces that we did comment on the original go round, and it's back. And it seems like those are kind of so far out that we're not thinking about those anymore. But we might need to dust them off and make another recommendation to council. And I tried to dig through my files, but I gotta say, the files are long. There was a lot of them. So I tried to pull some of the best ones that I could find. And I think what we did before, there's one from the RRPC that we kind of tacked on. And I think our recommendation was basically to follow what they said in there with, and I can remember some of the things that we had were infrastructure percent deduction, vacant buildable land, or not vacant buildable, I'm sorry, the market factor, Justin, you were pretty involved in that too. The schools and parks deduction, the conversion of critical areas to developable. There was a few of those recommendations that, that we had from before that we might want to just kind of bring back out and reiterate. They don't seem to always be in this in the new assumptions that they're doing.
So yeah, Eric, I was involved in that process. And so I think it's a variety of factors, many of which you've already mentioned. And many of the planning assumptions, you know, advocated for by the Responsible Planning Coalition didn't end up in the final VBLM and then buildable lands report. I think in kind of the materials laid out here today, this planning cycle is going to be a little more complicated, complying with House Bill 1110, House Bill 1337, and then 1220. So community planning has done a great job kind of giving their perspective. I think in this issue paper four, kind of in our packet here. And so going forward, I believe, and community planning staff can correct me, but capacity will be assessed on zoning rather than comp plan designation. And I think for the private sector, there's some questions about, you know, how that will happen. I think you also saw on the City of Vancouver's letter some concerns about going forward with legislative decisions in front of council before another vacant buildable lands model is run with the feedback from the cities. So I think the City of Vancouver is trying to advocate for, let's delay any legislative decision until the next run of the vacant buildable lands model is done with the input from the cities, and based on feedback from community planning at their September 20th workshop, they estimate that that next run of the VBLM with those inputs from the cities will be completed by the end of October. Again, that could change. And so they brought up a variety of points, community planning in their issue paper four, kind of, I guess, disagreeing with some assertions by the Department of Commerce on vacancy rate and then people per household, you know, fewer people per household, and kind of what that means for additional housing units needed. So I won't belabor anything. I think DEEB would be well served if they wanted to explore those planning assumptions in more depth and make a motion to council. So I will leave it there.
What time frame do we have on that? When is it coming back before council? Do we know?
I would have to check, Eric. Okay. But there is a pretty short timeline of trying to complete the public hearing, I believe, and again, community planning could correct me, kind of by October, end of October, getting that public hearing done and moving on with the process. Okay. So that's kind of what I think right now.
So what I want to avoid is taking too much time on it because it's very complicated, and we've already looked at it. We've already hashed this out. So I guess my thought is that I know Jamie was involved in it, I was involved, and I think Justin was pretty involved and a few other like external stakeholders. What we should probably do is just kind of reconvene, look through our notes. We had a very specific recommendations for VBLM last time, and it actually, council actually approved it. They recommended these pieces. And then it got thrown out at the last hearing because they threw everything out and just went with achieved density. And now since they're going back away from achieved density to those recommendations, we should just reiterate them and just dig through our notes, and it can be a very simple memo that, hey, we recommend this, the infrastructure deduction, a market factor, just those factors that go in and do that. So I don't want to take any more time here. I guess I'm just looking for direction, and maybe Jamie, if you're there, Jamie, you know, myself and Justin can go over those, and we'll come up with a recommendation to present to you guys for consideration, and then we can ratify it and pass it on to the board. That's
I think that'd be great, and I appreciate the effort on it. So it's pretty critical, and getting ahead of it and staying ahead of it is tough with how frequently we meet and then how things are changing as far as on the consideration and how the process is moving forward.
I don't think we're changing our direction. I really think it's just reiterating what we did before, because now that we're revisiting it, yeah, for us, we're going to find out what we did before and just represent it, because, you know, if it's too far down in that pile, it's not going to get considered. So we just need to, you know, reiterate and move it back
you
up
that
pile.
You can't present something too often, knowing that we've been dealing with certain aspects of this since I've been on this board for like the last 12 years. So.
Yep. So we'll try to come up with something, and we'll do it fairly quickly if you guys are available. Jamie, you on there still? Okay, well, I'll follow up with Jamie then.
So would that be for the next monthly meeting, or would it have to be before
I don't
that?
Know what time frame we have. We might have to do it in the next week or two and get it. I think sooner the better. And we'll try to figure it out. And again, I don't think it's a change in position. It is digging through the old notes, and I tried to do it. There was just too many. So I need a little more time. Okay. And I think Justin may have some material I didn't have, and Jamie may have stuff too. So if we can find it, dig it out. I have all of it in different places, but I know it's all in one place in some document that I haven't been able to find. So
when does the rubber hit the road in terms of the actual adoption process, maps and all that? I mean,
The comprehensive plan update is due June 30th, 2025. Now, they can grant a six-month extension, and I think some cities have advocated for that, and some other folks in our community, just how big the process is. So there is a potential for that six-month extension, but the goal, I think, is to have it done by June 30th, 2025.
And that's a every eight-year deal, or...?
So Eric may help me on this.
Seven.
There's
every seven.
And there's
every seven. I mean, it used to be every seven, but.
Every seven, there's a minor.
Okay. Is every seven? Okay.
All right. And then, Mike, I believe you had something.
Yeah, I had forgotten that I had a colleague of mine bring this to my attention. April, this might be for you or somebody else, permit center staff. When we went through quite a lengthy process with Susan Ellinger and Shannon Lazzarini and to update the pre-app process and the fully complete process and you know, kind of, I guess, square our the submittal requirements away with what was in code and, you know, getting rid of this, that, and adding that and whatever. And one of the things that came out of that, which I thought was really good, was there was, as kind of a concession for getting rid of the fully complete certification, which had been, you know, the law of the land for probably 15 years, if an application or if an applicant comes in with an application for a type 2, type 3 or type 2, type 2A or type 3 application, and now that everything is, you know, of course, we didn't have to go through a counter-complete process when we had the fully complete certification. Now that we have done away with that, every application goes through a counter-complete application process. But as a concession to that is that if you go through and you are and your submittal is counter-complete, then your fully complete review is 14 days. And if you weren't counter-complete and you had to add some additional stuff, then once it was submitted, then your fully complete process would be 21 days. And I believe that is in still the checklist, the type 2, type 2A, type 3 checklist. A colleague of mine brought it to our attention is that the permit center is taking 21 days for all fully complete reviews. And so I'm just kind of wondering what happened to that. I mean, we were able to, you know, sometimes shaving a week off the review process is, while it just seems like a week, it can be pretty meaningful, especially when, you know, every little bit of time we're trying to save, especially during the review process, is critical to our clients. So I'm just kind of curious as to whether or not there's been a change in policy to that all applications go through a 21-day fully complete process, or if that 14-day process with counter-complete applications right out of the gate is still the case.
And I guess, Mike, just to point out, you know, previously it was 14 days, and if there are minor corrections, you could still get fully complete within 21 days. Now it's you get a not fully complete at the end of 21 days, and then it's another 2-week review. So it's really more like an additional couple of weeks.
Yeah, so it's getting actually a little bit longer. Yeah. So
I don't know, Brent. I think you're the only one here that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious about that because I recall, you know, the same policy that you're referring to. I was, you know, kind of outside that process, but, you know, there have been couple changes in management of the program. There's been turnover in the staff that do the work, a couple of cycles of that. So I definitely can revisit it and see, you know, check in with the staff that are doing it now, see if something got missed in the training, see if they recall a decision made by you know, if something, a decision was made by Ted. And then we can revisit to see what we can possibly do to get back to that.
That'd be great.
You know, and just to be clear, the land use submittals don't go through the permit center. They come through land use.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, that could be something that's broken down with the handoff of how that occurs, because mm-hmm. we have one staff person primarily doing the intake
right.
and the counter complete and then handing it off. So that could be where a disconnect has occurred as well.
Okay.
So I'll look into it.
Great, great. Thank you. Appreciate it. That's all I have.
All right. Well, with that, we'll move to public comment. Is there anyone here that would like to provide public comment or online? All right. Well, hearing none. Our next DEEB meeting is scheduled for November 2nd, and this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.